that it wouldn't even be a factor of health of the mother when her life is threatened.
You know, as I said before, Judge Bannion, this woman would have been free to have this abortion even if she didn't have leukemia. She has leukemia, and that provides a rather compelling, I think by everybody's, I don't think anybody would deny seriously that if you are pregnant and you have to have chemotherapy for leukemia, this is not a good thing for the fetus. So I just don't understand, even in this case that you postulate here, how having this woman's abortion records or the other records associated with it is going to help the government show anything that is relevant in NAF versus Ashcroft. And I think certainly that this finding by Judge Koukouras, it has to be reviewable as an abuse of discretion. Relevance findings are always reviewed for abuse of discretion, whether it's evidence at trial or whether it's relevance in discovery. It's an abuse of discretion.
Let me ask you a more legal question. So as I take it, your view, I think, is that 212E creates a privilege, and that would be applicable in state cases, presumably state, federal, anything. Now, what about the government's argument that this will throw a real monkey wrench into federal litigation, for example, employment cases, ADA cases, Social Security disability cases, ERISA cases, where patient records are commonly introduced?
I think the argument has no merit for a number of reasons. Number one is that, for example, if the records are the litigants themselves, there isn't a state in the country that I know of that doesn't hold that any privilege that exists is waived. It isn't waived. It is waived. Illinois has got an explicit waiver, whether you are the
waiver for what? A party waiver?
Party waiver, whether you're the plaintiff or the defendant. And in fact, even if there's a privilege under federal common law, as I think there is, nobody would argue that that privilege isn't waived when you put your own health at issue. So the state laws always, like Illinois, all state laws, state laws don't create privileges in order to make life difficult for people. They all have exceptions which cover almost everything that the government names. But there's another reason not to worry about that too. And that is that there are other federal statutes, not Rule 501, but other federal statutes which have specific provisions in them about disclosure of records. For example, we cited some in our brief, OSHA, the Consumer Product Safety Act, the statutes relating to Medicare fraud. Those statutes were the first to concede would preempt any state privilege law that got in their way. The Fourth Circuit is so held in the context of Medicare fraud. And with those federal statutes protecting the right of the government to go after records when it needs them, no state privilege that gets in its way is going to survive. And so the government, the answer to the government's argument is, this is hyperbole. There will be cases now and then, and this is one of them. They're probably rare, but there will be cases now and then in which the judge's HIPAA holding, in fact, does interfere with the government's attempt to go after records, and for a good reason.
Now, the government says that you have no, I'm getting back to the benefit burden business, you have no burden because you're just a sort of conduit. So if the patients say to you, you know, we're really upset that you released our records, you just tell them, well, we had to, so don't blame us. Well, so then you wouldn't suffer any, you know, loss of consumer goodwill or whatever.
You know, with all respect to the government counsel, I don't think they've ever had to try to run a hospital. They've never had to run a hospital and deal with patients whose medical records you're turning over to the government for use in litigation which wants to criminalize forwardly the procedures that they went through. But the real answer to your question, Judge, is that it's not the hospital's burden that's the most important under Rule 45. It's the patient's. Rule 45 talks about an undue burden on, quote, any person, unquote. And it's clear under the case law and under the text that it doesn't have to be the person who is subject to the subpoena. It is the patients that are suffering the burden here.
Well, one of the arguments the government makes is there's no real chilling effect because all the identifying information is not included, and the testimony of Hammond would be taken under seal, so it wouldn't be available to the public. What's your response to that?
My first response is that the government has made a serious misstatement. There is nothing in Judge Casey's protective order that says that the testimony of Judge Hammond is going to be taken under seal. They said it in their brief twice. It is false. Look at paragraph 13 of the protective order, which is Exhibit 4. That says that the use of these records at trial will be decided by Judge Casey. That's all it says. And I don't know of any precedent for suddenly kicking everybody out of the courtroom in a public trial while you cross-examine the star witness with records. There is none. The government has not stated the facts to the court. Number two, the fact that Judge Koukouras found and Judge Hamilton found that under the extraordinary circumstances of this case, you cannot count on redaction to keep things foolproof in identifying people. And here's why that obviously makes sense, it seems to me. We're going to have a public trial in New York. It's going to start Monday. This is going to be a trial that is going to be watched around the world by the proponents and opponents of abortion alike. There is going to be, it is part of an ongoing culture war, if you want to put it that way, with bitterly committed advocates on both sides. Anybody who watches that trial and listens to the cross-examination of Dr. Hammond, if these records are allowed to be used to cross-examine him, is going to learn an enormous amount about the patient in question. They'll learn, for example, who the doctor was, Dr. Hammond. They'll know that the operation was performed at Northwestern Memorial Hospital, and they can deduce from that with a huge degree of certainty that the patient is likely from this area. They'll know that the case happened, because the government subpoena pinpoints the year, 2003. They'll learn a host of specifics about the patient. They'll learn the particular medical condition that prompted the referral for an abortion. They will learn details of her sexual history, if relevant, as Mr. Coffin said. They will learn details about drug use, and I assure you that that has been a relevant consideration in some of these records. They will learn complications of the abortion where that is relevant. These facts and other facts that they will learn could be posted that night on the Internet.
But how does that identify to the public, anybody?
It identifies to any number of people who may know this person, who may know that they have a friend who had an abortion. It could give any enterprising reporter or any enterprising activist on either side of the debate enough information so that it is reasonable to worry about their tracking the person down, or even suspecting, she's the one. And that's a risk that is unacceptable unless there is a very strong reason for taking it, and if Judge Koukouras...
So you're saying my co-workers or family members or someone might recognize, some acquaintance of the patient might recognize this information on the Internet, put two and two together.
Right. Well, for example, let's suppose that the patient in question has a friend, and she's told the friend that she, I had an abortion from Dr. Hammond last year at Northwestern. But let's suppose she didn't choose to share the reasons that led to that abortion. Let's suppose, for example, that she had been raped. Let's suppose that there was something like this. Anybody who knows that person and who guesses that this may be the person that they're talking about could say, now I know something I didn't know before. And that's something that she hadn't chosen to share with anybody. But now, because of this misguided subpoena, they could know.
What would Dr. Hammond then be able to testify about? Would he just say, I don't remember? When he goes in, he wouldn't be able to go into any detail about the specific operation. I guess I'm surprised they're only 45. That surprised me. I thought this was, maybe that's all the government wanted. I thought it was a much broader look at how often this procedure is done, and based on findings of Congress that says that it's, I guess, never necessary.
Yeah, well, that's right. There are about 45 in this case, but when you put together all these subpoenas that have been scattered around the country, there are hundreds of patients that have been. There is probably a significant percentage of second trimester abortion patients in this country who have had these procedures, this DNX procedure, whose records have been subpoenaed, because this is a very small group of doctors who is willing to do these procedures. In any event, That's the, what you asked is what Dr. Hammond could testify to. He would testify to exactly what's in his affidavit, which he'll be testifying about anatomy. Here is the uterus.
No, he testifies about these diseases that you're talking about people that someone with leukemia. Isn't that enough to identify someone?
It could be.
Why don't you say that it is?
But that's just, you know, he is only testifying in generic terms about reasons why most of those references to individual patients, Judge Mannion, were contained in the initial section of his affidavit in which he simply explains what kinds of patients come to him for abortion. That testimony is not what he's really testifying to is relevant to NAFB Ashcroft. It's introductory testimony saying, here's when I get involved. But what the heart of his testimony is, to answer your specific question, the heart of his testimony is, look, here is what the anatomy of an abortion is. And here is why I think that removing the fetus in a second trimester abortion as intact as possible tends to minimize certain risks. It is a matter of anatomy. If you have a fetus which is in the uterus and you are reaching into the uterus with sharp instruments and trying to dissect fetal material that way, that's likely to lead to perforations and bleeding.
And then he will go further than that because he will then talk about various diseases that then, in his opinion,
sure,
would require this type of approach versus the other alternatives.
Exactly.
Is that right?
Exactly right. He'll say, that's a risk with any patient, but if you have, for example, a complication which puts you at greater risk of bleeding anyway, it'll be a bigger risk. And so that's what he'll testify to. It is an anatomy lesson. And the government experts on the other side are presumably going to say, look, it is always as safe to do it by the in utero D&E method. It's always as safe. Congress is right. It's always as safe. And then Judge Casey will decide, have they really established that it's always as safe or not? But the individual medical records are not going to cast light on that issue before Judge Casey. It is a little hard to understand what the exactly how things will play out at trial, but that's the best that Judge Koukouras could make out. It's the best that Judge Hamilton could make out, and I think they're right. They certainly didn't abuse their discretion.
As I understand it, that he categorically says they did not do any abortions after, I thought it was maybe 24 weeks.
Right. He never does. He never does.
Liability, I suppose.
Exactly. He never does abortions, and it's not an issue as to whether he does abortions of a fetus that could be viable. Never. So that's really when you get down to relevance, you then go to the other question that he asked. He said, look, about redaction. And Judge Posner, I think, brought this up before Mr. Coffin, which is that it isn't enough just to say redaction solves privacy problems, even if you think the method is foolproof, which it isn't. That isn't enough. It's too simplistic. And the reason for it is that the way reasonable people regard this kind of fishing expedition is a reasonable second trimester abortion patient has been through a difficult time. Everybody will admit that. And the more emotional, the more wrenching, the more intimate, the more profoundly personal a procedure is, the less redaction is a solution to anything in terms of invasion of privacy. We don't think that across-the-board rules about redaction make the most sense, although Illinois has such a rule. We think that there are probably situations in which the nature of the treatment at issue is such that maybe redaction would reduce concerns to a tolerable level if there was a good reason for getting these records. But when you come to second trimester abortion, any reasonable woman is going to think that it is an intrusion into her privacy when the government goes out and nabs these records against her will in a case that she is not a party to for the purpose of criminalizing an operation that she underwent. No reasonable woman would fail to think that that was a serious intrusion on her privacy, as Judge Koukouras found. And because she would feel that way, she and other women may act on that feeling. They may act on that feeling by being more reluctant to seek treatment when they need it, when they're pregnant. And that's a risk that we do not want to take unless there is a powerful countervailing reason. And there is no such powerful countervailing reason in this case. That's why we said that when Judge Koukouras made that finding of relevance, and when he made this finding about intrusion into privacy, the question wasn't whether to quash the subpoena. The only interesting question is what the most appropriate grounds were. And I'd be glad to go into that. You've been very tolerant with us on time. We're glad to answer questions about that, although the briefs lay out the legal arguments in great detail. I want to stick up, in such time as I have remaining, I want to stick up with the judge's HIPAA reasoning. And I think that, in fact, the judge is absolutely right in his HIPAA holding.
You're talking about Judge Koukouras?
Yes. And here's why. The preemption scheme of HIPAA, which is in sections 262 and 264C2, is a very unusual preemption scheme. It's unique as far as I can tell. The typical preemption clause says, look, if there's a conflict between the state and federal provision, the federal provision wins. That's the typical preemption clause, and there's a lot of them. And then there's a typical saving clause as well. And the typical saving clause says, we don't deem there to be a conflict between the federal and state provision, and they can both survive. You've got to comply with them both. Pollution laws are a very good example. But HIPAA sections 262 and 264C2 do much more than this. They provide both a preemption provision and what I think could be called a reverse preemption provision. And here's how they do it. Section 262 says if a state's privacy standard provides less privacy protection than the applicable HIPAA standard, then the state standard is preempted and the federal standard wins. So far, so good. That's just the standard preemption provision. But then comes the reverse preemption provision, which is unique as far as I can tell. It says that if a state's privacy standard provides more privacy than the federal standard, and it's impossible to comply with both, that's the caveat that the government always chooses to leave out.
Well, the government argues that the way to comply with both is that the stringent state privilege applies in state court and federal diversity cases, and the lower federal standard in federal question decisions. I don't know what they do about federal question decisions in state courts. That didn't come up. But putting that aside, so do you have a comment on whether that is a reasonable argument?
Yes, that is their argument. But the problem with it is that the plain language of the privacy standard doesn't just restrict itself to state court proceedings. The privacy standard is an absolutely indiscriminate provision. It applies to all judicial proceedings, state and federal, and it applies to all federal proceedings, federal question or state law question. And so because it does, you have the following situation. On the one hand, you have a state law, Illinois law, which says, flatly tells a hospital, as interpreted by the courts, that it cannot disclose this information. It doesn't say that you cannot disclose this information except in federal judicial proceedings. It just says you can't disclose it. It's a prohibition. You violate the law by disclosing it according to the face of the law. And then you have a HIPAA standard, which is applicable in federal question judicial proceedings in federal court, which says that you can, if you choose, disclose this information. So there you have it. You have a state standard that says you can't, and you have a federal standard that says you can. This is a conflict, irreconcilable. You can't both disclose and not disclose. And that's where 264C2 kicks in. And it says where there is this conflict, the state law trumps. It says that the state law continues. And there would be no reason to say that the state law continues in effect when you have an irreconcilable conflict between the two if it didn't mean that the state law prevails over the federal law.
But doesn't it only apply to individually identifiable records?
Yes.
Because if you redact, at least according to HIPAA, that comes out from under the exception in the preemption then applies.
Yes, but that's a problem with that argument. There's three problems with that argument, which the government, as you pointed out, Judge Mannion, the government never made.
Right.
But there are three problems with it. Judge Casey made a sort of stab at that argument, although it wasn't clear. But there are three problems.
He relied more on the protective order.
Yes,
he said, even so, this would apply.
Yeah. But there are three problems with it. Number one, it's circular. If we're talking about what we're starting with as HIPAA envisages it, as far as I can read the statute, if we're starting with the records as they are identifiable health information, and the question is, what do we then do? But a second answer, Judge Mannion, is this, that in fact, simply getting all of those particular laundry list items out of the records does not necessarily remove them from HIPAA, because if there is other information in the records that makes them potentially identifiable, and the word is potentially, then there is still a HIPAA problem and they are still protected health information.
Well, HIPAA allows that redaction, though.
It allows, but if you redact those things, then you are taking out the reason why the government won't.
Maybe. That's a good question. Maybe it is.
Well, the government says they're not bound by, that a court isn't bound by 514.
Yeah, I heard them say that. I don't understand that. But that's what the text of HIPAA says. And as far as legislative history is concerned, I agree with you that it's what's in the text that really counts. But to the extent that HHS focused on this particular problem, it agreed with us. And that's in the final preamble, that long document that it issued with the HIPAA standards. And it was asked, what is the effect of 264C2, the preemption provision, the anti-preemption provision, in a, quote, federal civil lawsuit, unquote, when a subpoena says disclose, but a state law says doesn't? They answer the question, the state law governs. This was a provision of legislative history that the government did not see fit to tell you in their opening brief, and when we pointed it out, all they can do in the reply brief is bury their response in a footnote and says, well, they must have been talking about diversity cases. That wasn't the question they were asked, and it wasn't the answer that they gave. So to the extent that we have plain language and legislative history that means anything, we should win the HIPAA fight. But it doesn't matter, because there are so many other grounds to affirm the subpoena on, starting, for example, with the Shader Doctrine. The Shader Doctrine is a principle of federal common law. It's imported into Rule 501. It comes from this court, and it's been adopted by courts everywhere. And what it says is that if you can apply a state law privilege in a federal question case without substantial harm to government federal interests, you must do it. Not you may do it, but you must do it. And if it's true, as Judge Kokoris said, that these records have no serious relevance and that the parties are going to prove their case with expert testimony, if that's true, and I think we have to take it as true, then Shader kicks in automatically. And you don't even reach, for example, the question of redaction, because Illinois has decided that question. And the comity principle in Shader says, if we can do you a favor and observe your law, we'll do it, as long as we don't make it hard on federal interests. And because it won't make it hard on federal interests in this case, Shader requires affirmance on that ground alone, even though Judge Kokoris didn't reach it. I've already talked about Rule 45, and I'm obviously pushing my limit, and I will be fine.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Gowans.